Welcome to the best of Studio Tulsa in 2021. This program was recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The millennial generation was once touted as the most positive, forward-thinking generation in American history. But this generation has been rocked by a pandemic, two once-in-a-lifetime economic downturns, and technological changes that have disrupted career and job paths. Now that this generation is reaching its 30s, is it any surprise that millennials are delaying the traditional mileposts of adulthood? Finishing school, leaving home, marriage, financial independence, and having children. And are these markers still relevant today? Well, my guest today followed eight subjects in their 30s for 2 years as they negotiated these markers of adulthood for her book, But You're Still So Young, How 30-somethings Are Redefining Adulthood. Kayleen Schaefer followed these subjects, straight, gay, white, people of color, single, coupled, parents, and child-free, through their major life events, coupled by data on this generation that still often lives with their parents, who are carrying loads of debt and are delaying marriage and child-rearing. Kayleen Schaefer is a journalist and author of Text Me When You Get Home. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, Vogue, and other publications. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Kayleen Schaefer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Your book, But You're Still So Young, follows eight subjects in their 30s from every demographic slice of America as they negotiate these landmarks sociologists have defined as the markers of adulthood, finishing school, leaving home, marrying, becoming financially independent, and having children. These are traditional markers, but are they holding up in this generation?
They are not. It's a low statistic of people in their 30s who have checked off all of those five boxes by the time they're 34. Only 24% of people by the time they're 34 have checked off all five of those markers.
Now, is that a big change from previous generations?
It's a huge change. Even as recently as 1975, 48% of people had checked off those markers by the time they were 34. So that's a big drop, and it's only continuing to drop. The age of hitting all these markers is only continuing to rise, according to the experts that I talk to, but then also just watching real people live through their 30s. Like, they are just not checking these things off in a line anymore.
When you look at every one of those measures, things about those measures have changed for the most part. When you think about finishing school, in 1975, finishing school might have just meant high school.
Yeah, as you more education is required to compete in the knowledge economy. So, you know, college is more or less of a requirement, and even graduate school.
Graduate school, and also that affects financial independence because, you know, what you see is among your subjects, those that have finished school, debt is a big part of all of their lives.
It's a huge part. The majority of the people I talked to in the book were carrying student debt, and people in their 30s have just far, far more student debt than older generations. It's just part of being in your 30s now that you have this student debt.
Well, it's interesting that these markers are byproducts of the 1950s in a lot of ways. And I was really struck by something you were writing about, how that 1950s vision of finishing school, leaving home, finding the right mate, marrying, becoming financially independent, and then having children is really deeply ingrained, even in this generation of 30-somethings and probably 20-somethings as well. And I find it interesting because that 1950s generation was the most mobily upward decade in American history. In many ways, It's not, while it is pitched as the ideal, it's not been the case for most of American history.
Yeah, you are completely right. But I was so taken by this stereotype and this ideal of the 1950s that it really took a long time to get through my head as I started researching this book and talking to experts that period in time is a real anomaly. But for whatever reason, and the reason is actually because it was, people were doing well, people were upwardly mobile. It's just thought of as a simpler time in this rosy picture that we have of the 1950s. And so that's why the stereotype is so popular, and that's why people look to it, even though it's not actually how we're living and haven't been living for a long time. But it is still, like, I didn't know why I personally thought that that was going to be my life, even as I was taking steps that showed me that I clearly wasn't going to set up my life this way. But But that ideal is just right there.
And this was a thought I had throughout the book, is how media has shaped the vision of life for all of these eight subjects. And when I think about the 1950s, I think this is the first decade where the 1950s are still with us. You can see them on cable television every night, you know? And I'm wondering if that is why this has such a powerful influence, this media vision that was created on television in the 1950s of what an ideal family is, and it's stuck with us.
Yeah, the 50s were the advent of television. So those are our first televised images of what American life looks like. And I mean, anyone can recall it, you know, picket fences, kids lying on their floor to watch TV. Dad comes in, drops his briefcase on the floor, and they run up to greet him. Dinner table, you know, mom puts the dinner down and the family eats together. It's those images are just, they're very American and they're very ingrained. And so we can easily recall that because there is a living memory of the 1950s. But your point about media is interesting, too, because now for people in their 30s, when they hear media, obviously, you know, we watch Netflix, we watch all kinds of streaming services, but we also have social media. And that is another way you can see people checking off these boxes. And if you look and people post about, you know, their engagements, or they're having kids, or they bought a home, or they got a promotion. So all of those accomplishments are in your face. And if you're someone sitting there not ready to post about that accomplishment or wondering like, oh, am I behind? Am I okay? What am I doing? You know, it's very hard to figure out what's real and what's for social media only.
I absolutely agree with that. The idea that, you know, the check-ins is a constant thing. So you're constantly measuring yourself against your peers, your contemporaries. And that leads to, I guess, the huge amount of stress that nearly all of your subjects seem to be feeling.
Yeah, it's interesting because we're also an age group that we're told in our 20s, it's okay, take a breather, find yourself, experiment, you know, try different jobs, live different places, date different people. But then there's this idea of this age 30 deadline where you hit 30 and it's like, okay, now you should have it all figured out, make everything fall into place. And so almost it's just like running into this brick wall. And it's like, but wait, why don't you have everything figured out? We gave you your 20s to do this, but it's not as simple as, okay, now I can just set everything in place. It's much more difficult than that, which does cause a lot of anxiety and frustration. You know, why can't I just make my life fall into place immediately?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, but at the same time, this was also the generation that worked harder oftentimes than any other generation, maybe going back to the pre-labor laws of, you know, the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, we're 70, 80-hour work weeks. You know, the gig economy was sort of ingrained in them that this was the way they were going to get ahead.
Yeah, we are absolutely. We're the freelancers. We're the gig employees. You know, we're the people who have, like, second jobs that are just passion jobs that aren't real. They don't pay us anything, but we want to do that alongside our real job. And it is, there's just this mentality of work all the time, and that will get you somewhere. And I think a lot of people are looking up and saying, but where is all this work getting me? Because we don't have, like you said, pre-labor laws. Like, we don't have the kind of protection that workers used to have, or the kind of salaries. You know, our salaries aren't increasing with the time either.
Yeah. And of course, this generation has been whacked by so many waves of change. You know, there's been technological changes in the workplace, reset on the business employee relationship, you know, what being an employee means, and what are the responsibilities of the employer to the employee, and what is the responsibilities of the employee to the employer. You know, we've had boom and bust economies now, you know, the Great Recession of 2008 that set everybody way back. Now a pandemic. This generation has been reeling from just a series of major body punches throughout their life.
I like to say it as we're dealing with our second once-in-a-lifetime recession, like you said, in 2008 and now. And so that's a lot of financial instability in very few years in between.
Well, it's interesting as we go through the list of folks that you followed, eight subjects. Marcus is an interesting case. Marcus is has got a good job. He hates his job when we first meet him. He's an auditor, and he's looking for a better position. And he seems to be marked by this idea that, and he's, in fact, he's making a decent salary, but it's not enough. Maybe it's not enough in terms of the debt he owes from his college education, but it seems like he is really going for that American dream, and it doesn't seem like he's running into it, and he's finding it a tremendous source of frustration.
Yes, what's interesting about Marcus, in my conversation with Marcus, we talked a lot about what his dad thought of what he was doing concerning his work, because his dad kept saying, you know, you have a good job, just sit back, relax, you know, do your work, go home, don't look for anything more, that's all there is, there's work and there's home. And for Marcus, he's looking for a job that he's passionate about, that he really feels like, does it matter if I come to work every day? So he's also working on his side passion project and trying to make that his real job, but he can't seem to because, you know, he just keeps getting hired as an auditor. And so he's pushing and pulling with that struggle to make himself happy in his work life. Then he also has the idea that once he's happy in his work life, he'll be able to straighten out his personal life. When we first meet him, his girlfriend, they're long distance. He lives in Austin and she lives in Chicago, and he wants to find a new job before she moves to him. And so you can see just how complicated it is to set up this perfect life that he wants. And I don't know, can we do that? Like, can we make everything fall into place perfectly?
And of course, that father-son tension is, again, a changing dynamic. His father worked for the state and worked there for 40 years and retired with a wonderful pension. Those jobs are so few and far between now.
Exactly. We don't have pensions. Very, very few people.
You know, even 401k programs that, you know, that actually contribute something so that you can actually retire with something like a pension are, you know, that is the gold ring now.
And it's 401k is relatively new. I actually didn't know that because I've had a 401k since I started working, but I didn't realize just how recently they'd been put into place.
Well, let's talk about the first marker of adulthood, finishing school. Again, with the high cost of education, this has become a real obstacle for a lot of people. Tell me a little bit about Charles, who's sort of the story of finishing school. He's obviously a bright guy and has done well when he's been given opportunities. It's just the lack of a degree is always holding him back.
I look at finishing school through the lens of Charles, like you said, and Charles lives in Jacksonville, Florida, and he had finished his associate's degree, but had about $20,000 of debt from just those 2 years. So he decided to join the National Guard in hopes that he could get that debt paid off by his service to the National Guard. But then, unfortunately, he failed a physical exam, and that meant that they would no longer repay his debt. So he left the National Guard. Now he's 2 more years behind in school, and gets a job with a mortgage broker, and he's working and he's good at his job, but he keeps trying to get promoted, but keeps being told, well, you need a degree for these jobs. He's not actually overtly ever told this, but he suspects that when he sees who they hire and they have a degree. And in the meantime, he's also, you know, going to school in his spare time and really trying to finish his degree. But as he says over and over, you know, he's not a great student. He really wants that degree, but it is very hard for him to continue to take the classes and work toward it, because he's also actually just doing the job that the degree is required for. So you can see how that's also a very complicated position to be in. You know, he's doing the work, but being told he needs this degree, even though he's already doing the work.
And that is a real issue moving forward for our society, the whole emphasis on education that may or may not be required to do the job. And we've put this barrier in place, and it's a prohibitively expensive barrier in so many ways.
You just watch as Charles gets in more and more debt, just trying to basically do the best he can. And because he also works for a mortgage broker, he goes ahead and buys a house because he's told, you know, if you're going to sell mortgages, you should also have one. And so that just, it's putting him in more debt, even though he now owns a home.
Of course, for this generation, one of the big arrangements now, ages 18 to 34, still living with one's parents. And you have subjects in your book that were out on their own and found out they had to come back home in Sally's case, to a retirement community.
That story is so. Both of those, her name's actually Lucy, and her husband Matt. They got married, and Matt was finishing his PhD, and they just figured, okay, well, Matt will get a job, and we'll move to wherever he gets a job. And he finished his PhD and didn't get a job. And they were going to go live with Lucy's parents, but her parents happened to live in a retirement community in South Carolina for ages 60 and older. So they went down and they stayed with them. And, you know, they watched Fox News in the exercise room. And, you know, they had cocktails on the veranda overlooking the golf course. They watched Wheel of Fortune with her parents every night. So in such a... charming in a way, but you know, Lucy said they'd been there a couple weeks and it just started to be really, what are we doing with our lives? How come we didn't even get a job and we're already in the retirement community?
Right. Talk a little bit about the idea of, you know, having to come back and live with the parents. Is it just simply economic conditions?
You know, it's interesting. The majority of people in my book did, like you said, return to live with their parents at some point. And it wasn't always economic, although in many cases it was. One woman was saving to buy her own home. But it also happened after a breakup, too. One of the men went to live back with his parents after a breakup. But I think it's interesting that it's usually generally seen as a negative thing if your adult child goes home to live with you. But I think that's changing, especially now, because during the pandemic, so many adult children went to live with their parents, whether it was just for safety and security, whether it's because they could no longer afford to pay rent, whether it's because they got furloughed from their job. And so I think that people are starting to see it as a better thing. You know, it's smart financially. It's not bad to keep families close together. This is something that happens in like Italy all the time, that families support each other under one roof. And so I think that that mindset is shifting as more and more people are doing it. And like you said, for people ages 18 to 34, it is the most common living arrangement, back with their parents.
That wasn't necessarily the norm in America for most of its history. It's only really in the 20th century that that changed.
Mm-hmm. It's very recent.
And oftentimes it would be children living with the parents. Eventually, maybe the children would do well and then have their own place, and then the parents would come and live with them. I mean, it was multi-generational. Used to be a norm in America, but that's changed.
It has. But I think that we're going to see it change back, especially now, because I think the pandemic has really kicked off this, that it's a new normal for a lot of families.
And in the pandemic, what is the role of the children living at home with the parents? Is it more of a helper for the parents at this point?
I think it's probably more of a help for the adult children, to be honest. I think the parents are probably glad to have them around. Like in Lucy and Matt's case, Lucy said her mom was really sad to see them go and loved having them there. But I do think older generations just tend to have more financial stability. They were able to buy homes, like we talked about before. They have pensions, so they have economic security in a way that people in their 30s and also in their 20s just haven't established that kind of security yet. And they're really lucky if they do have parents who can help them and give them a hedge against financial downfall.
Well, and of course, you know, even for the parents, though, I have to tell you, I can hear parents talking to the radio right now, is that pensions have been gone a lot longer. There are a lot of parents who may be supporting 30-somethings in their home who don't have pensions either, because the pensions went away in the 60s and 70s from businesses, and they converted them, and they're not the same thing. But that said, what was also interesting is the financial independence part, which I think more than half of Americans 21 to 37 are still receiving some financial assistance from those parents. Everything from cell phone bills to rent, groceries, gas, and this financial independence is another thing that's being greatly delayed in this generation.
It sure is. And, you know, when you say that statistic, first of all, it's 53% of younger people have received some sort of financial assistance from their parents or their grandparents. And you think, like, what? But then when you talk about, oh, but it could just be paying a cell phone bill, paying for groceries, you know, giving them their old car, giving them free childcare. You know, these are not huge sums of money. Like, we tend to think of the trust fund or like the kid being given millions. They're gifts from parents who can give them, who have the ability to give their children this help. And it's a real boon to the kids who are getting them, because it does help provide more financial stability in this time when, you know, jobs aren't secure, we're being furloughed, wages aren't rising with the cost of living, everything is more expensive, our health care, our child care, homes.
My guest today is Kayleen Schaefer. Her new book is titled, But You're Still So Young, How 30-somethings Are Redefining Adulthood. And it follows eight subjects in their 30s as they work through the markers of what sociologists have called adulthood, finishing school, leaving home, marrying, becoming financially independent, and having children. On becoming financially independent, how big an issue is student debt and college debt?
I think it's a huge issue because that's a payment that you make every month. And most people who have student debt are still making that payment in their 30s. And someone in the book described it as like just an unwelcome guest at a party that he goes to. So it's just something that's kind of always there and you're dealing with it. You just sort of accept the reality of it, but it obviously makes it so that you're putting that money to pay off your education versus putting it, say, in savings or toward a down payment on a home.
I think one subject in the book was really that became a major stressor in their life until I think it was a parent who said, don't worry about it, just pay it and don't let it overtake your life. And I found that interesting that debt was so overwhelming to their sense of their financial independence and their self-worth.
Yeah, I mean, the person in the book, his debt was just hanging over him. Every month he would just calculate how much money he had left over to live on after he sent his student loan payment. And, you know, he asked his dad, and this is a very low question, but, you know, what if something happened to me, what would happen to my debt? And his dad said, you know, very matter-of-factly, well, I would have to pay it because his dad had co-signed the loan with him. Then he said, look, like, it's just debt. No one's dying from this. And that led the character to arrive at the conclusion that it is just debt and it will be there for as long as it's there, as like an unwanted guest at a party.
Let's talk about marriage and having children. Mm-hmm. Is this the area where things have changed the most? Or what would you say of these five markers?
They have all changed a ton, but I do think that in the social markers, you can see how much society has changed and how much the expectations of society have changed, particularly in the birth rate. The birth rate now is the lowest it's been in 35 years. And demographers don't particularly, like, they don't know exactly why. They thought after the 2008 recession, the birth rate would go up, you know, like it did after the Great Depression. When people were doing better, they started to have kids again, but it hasn't. So that just shows you how much couples and women in particular are thinking about having children has changed. They're waiting later to do it. They want to establish their careers and their own financial independence before they do it. And I think that marriage also falls along those same lines. I think largely the delay in marriage is because women have changed, or what society says women can do has changed here. You know, marriage used to be the first step in kicking off an adult life for a woman, and it's no longer true that it is, so people are waiting later to get married.
Yeah, in fact, in many cases, it's the last step.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, I think a lot of people were predicting that we might see a birth rate jump with the pandemic. In fact, the opposite is the case. Demographers believe that the quarantine has basically shut that down as well.
Right. So when we got shut in or locked in, a lot of people said, well, maybe there'll be a baby boom. Couples are locked at home together with nothing to do. One of the characters in my book, though, he happened to be contemplating a third child with his wife. They have two, and they did want to try to have a third, and they were really excited about doing it. And then the pandemic started, and I checked in with him, and he was just like, are you expletive kidding me? Well, how could we do that right now? We are definitely putting that on hold. And I think a lot of people feel the same way. I don't think, as one of the demographers in the book said to me, I don't think people are saying, let's have a baby in the middle of the greatest pandemic that the country has experienced in hundreds of years.
Well, tell us a little bit about the eight people as you follow them through there. Has anything changed greatly in their lives from the time you started following them to the time you finished following them?
A lot of things have changed. And it was interesting because I started this and I didn't really know what would happen in their lives. And I followed them for over 2 years. And part of me was worried, well, what if nothing happens? What if we as people in our 30s aren't really doing anything? But plenty of things happened. One of the couples had their first child. Charles got a new job, who we're talking about. One of the women who started off, she was living at home. She now lives on her own. She paid rent for a full year and was super proud of herself for doing that. Marcus did get a new job. Lots of changes in their lives, which was exciting to watch because it's not necessarily the milestones that we think of in the 1950s definition, but these are milestones that are important to people in their 30s, such as like maybe moving across the country to start a new career, or, you know, for women, freezing their eggs. These are different milestones, but they don't make you any less adult when you get to them or realize that you want them and you accomplish them.
So these are not necessarily milestones completely deferred. They're just milestones delayed?
They're delayed and they're adding new ones. I think people are choosing what milestones they want and they are doing them on their own timelines. And as a collective, even though we're all individuals doing different things, as a collective, I think this gives everyone permission to do your own thing and to make your 30s how you want to set them out instead of just trying to put yourself in this mold that exists.
You know, this generation, the 30-somethings, were sort of the millennial generation. And I remember when this generation was coming up, it was the most positive generation. This was what demographers were saying. It was the most positive, working for social good generation we'd ever seen. Has any of that changed given all of the changes they've endured in their 30-something years?
You know, it's interesting because I started this book largely full of positivity, that this was a good thing. We were up against challenges, but, you know, it's a good thing that we have all of these choices. You know, we can choose to do certain things in our lives and choose not to do them. But then as I've been reporting, and obviously with the pandemic and the economic fallout because of it, I did wonder, am I being too positive? You know, is this, should we give up? Should I be a little more defeated? And, you know, I think obviously there are a lot of structural problems with how the U.S. is set up and a lot of systemic racism that we'll run into and will cause some people not to be able to make the lives that they want. But I do think that on the whole, people are largely positive. And the people I followed in my book when the pandemic started and we had a little time to catch our bearings and figure out, you know, what we were going to do now, they were continuing on with what they wanted to do. You know, they were maybe zigging or zagging in a different way, but they weren't frozen. They weren't just that this is too hard, I can't do it. You know, people are still trying to make the lives they want.
Well, Kayleen, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Author and journalist Kayleen Schaefer speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book, But You're Still So Young, How 30-somethings Are Redefining Adulthood, is published by Dutton. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.